This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Phil Dave, and coming up on this program. Following on from the Mount Meron disaster, journalist Nathan Jaffe updates us on what's being referred to as one of the darkest days in Israel's history. A fitting memorial to the victims of COVID-19, businessman and philanthropist Sir Lloyd Dorfman, CBE, tells us why he is throwing his support behind St. Paul's Cathedral's latest project. Remembering Major Lionel Mansell-Juan, who was he and why was he worthy of a plaque in his name? The British ambassador to Israel, Neil Wigan, joins me to celebrate 100 years since the work of a true hero. And a much-deserved royal accolade for BEAM, the charity that helps those who are homeless back into work. Their founder, Alex Stephanie, gives us an insight into their extraordinary efforts. But first, it's time for a look at your copy of the Jewish News, and joining me to go through it for this week is editor Richard Ferrer and news editor Justin Cohen. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Phil.
Now, as nice as it is to see you, it's not so nice to see the front page this week because, of course, there's only one story it could possibly reflect, and that is the somewhat horrific scenes we saw at the Lag BaOmer celebration, or what should have been a celebration, last week.
The worst disaster in Israeli history involving civilians. It's a time to mourn 45 people, many of them children, many of them teenagers, who were crushed to death in the stampede on the mountain celebrating Lag BaOmer last week. I don't know about you, but my thoughts, and I think the thoughts of some of my colleagues, turned to Hillsborough 1989, when a stampede, a crush, killed 96 Liverpool fans in very similar tragic circumstances. Now, of course, for years and years afterwards, there was acrimony and anger about the way that Hillsborough was reported and the lack of justice to the victims. But eventually there was an independent panel, safety was looked at, how it was compromised, and the legacy of those 96 people has been increased safety and security at mass public sporting events. What the legacy of the 45 who died at Mount Meron will be, I'm not so sure and I'm not so confident. What lessons are going to be learned and who is going to take responsibility? The squirming, the excuses, the blame game has already begun. The public security minister has said he takes responsibility, but that doesn't mean he's to blame. I'm not entirely sure what semantic nonsense that is. Questions need to be answered about who arranged this dangerous folly, the cramping into tiny spaces on a mountaintop. In the same way that it's apparently been taking place for decades, we found out that 100 years ago, 11 people were killed in similar fashion. So clearly, lessons need to be learned for next year. Lessons haven't been learned for 100 years. It would probably have been better to have cancelled the whole thing, but I think the people that arrange it have no interest in obeying the restrictions that have been implemented on them by the government. And the government appear to give them license to do as they please, appear to give them license to act as they please, and the outcome has been a tragedy.
Well, I think that obviously, to be fair, that I can't help but wonder whether or not the excitement caused at the prospect of doing something remotely normal in inverted commas, post-pandemic state of Israel was just the driving force between so many people in one place, that coupled with religion. I guess that we won't necessarily know for weeks to come, if at all, and we will be finding out more about that very story and that very sad situation with journalist Nathan Jaffe later in this programme. Justin, been a new poll that looks at the attitudes towards visiting Israel. What's this?
That's right. Well, we're expecting any moment now the announcement from the government on the first green list, the set of countries that British tourists will be allowed to travel to and back from without quarantining. And it's expected that that list will include Israel, which of course has put on the best and most effective vaccine rollout program in the world so far. But it's also expected to include a few other countries. And we polled through the company Comres this week 2,144 British adults across a representative sample of the country to gauge, first of all, whether they feel, which countries they feel have handled the coronavirus pandemic most effectively, and secondly, which countries they consider tourist destinations for them, both before the pandemic and afterwards. And strikingly, Israel is the only country in the list of 13 countries that we included in this poll where there is now an increase in interest post-pandemic. Literally none of the other countries, America, Brazil, France, Germany, see an increase after the pandemic. And I think, although it's only a small increase of 1%, that number of people across the country translates to quite a few potential new tourists.
And it has to be said that however horrific it is that it's taken a pandemic to do this, I feel as though, and I can't explain why I feel this, but I feel as though that there has been a bit of a shift in attitude towards Israel as a result of the pandemic, in the sense that suddenly it's not seen as this country riddled with evil, which so many people seem to have this ridiculous misconception that it is. They're finally starting to see that there are actually an awful lot of good things to come out of Israel. I don't know why it is, because I haven't openly discussed this with people, especially people who had no interest in going to Israel before, but it's just something I get the impression of. Anyway, but certainly the polls seem to show that, which is certainly very exciting. Got time just for one more story. Presidential elections for the Board of Deputies, and of course Jewish News this week hosted an official debate between the two potential candidates.
We did indeed. It was a full and frank exchange of views between Jonathan Neumann, the challenger, and Marie van der Zyl, the incumbent. Lots and lots of very interesting questions, some of which sparked a serious clash of opinions. We discussed the board's report into racial inclusivity in the community, which I know that we have discussed at length over the last few weeks. We discussed one of the challengers, Jonathan Neumann's book, in which he arguably disparaging against progressive Judaism, which I think has caused some umbrage amongst reform deputies. Interestingly, we discussed the potential merger, which has been rumbling along for many years now with the Jewish Leadership Council. Neither candidate held much truck towards that one. They both didn't seem to think that there was any cause for closer ties between the Jewish Leadership Council and the Board of Deputies, despite the fact that there's been a lot of duplication and wasted resources as a result of the two crossing over in many different key areas of the community. Obviously, I'm not someone who's going to be voting. I'm not a deputy, but the decision to be made on Sunday will clearly shape the future direction of our community for the next 3 years.
And I dare say it'll be very interesting to see what happens one way or another. Gentlemen, thank you both very much indeed. I'm afraid that is all we've got time for a look at the paper for this week. But don't forget, if you are at home, if you are isolating, you're unable to leave the house for whatever reason, then you can always find the full copy of the Jewish News as it would be in print if you go to jewishnews.co.uk. Editor Richard Ferrer, news editor Justin Cohn, thank you both very much indeed.
Thanks, Phil.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, last week we learned the horrific news that at least 45 people died. Many of them were crushed to death at a stampede that broke out at an overcrowded Lag BaOmer event in the north of Israel. Over 100 were injured, many of them critical, as medical staff really did struggle to evacuate people who were trapped at the scene at Mount Meron. Well, Nathan Jaffe is a journalist based in Israel who's been following this very closely, and I'm pleased to say joins me now. I'm not so pleased for the reason, Nathan, but thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the Jewish News Podcast. Just first and foremost, where are we at now? Because I think most people are aware with what happened last week, but where are we at? I assume that some people are still hospitalised, and do we know the official numbers yet even?
Yeah, there are still people who are in hospital, and there are blood drives taking place nationally. By the way, one of the frustrations of British people who've moved here is that many of them are unable to give blood because of the BSE crisis many years ago. So most Brits can't give blood. That's one of the frustrations. But blood is being collected. People are still in hospitals. And in all 45 cases of fatalities, the people have been buried now. and families are sitting shiver.
Which, of course, is some stark contrast to, of course, what should have been the first major event, if you will, post-pandemic, in inverted commas, even though the pandemic still very much continues. The fact that most of Israel has now been vaccinated, it was supposed to be that this was the first pretty major event that people, well, for once, feel a bit more normal again.
Absolutely. I mean, I was one of a very tiny handful of people who was actually at the event last year. There was hardly anybody there. Just a few hundred people were allowed there last year. I can't tell you how many police checkpoints I had to go through, how many times I had to show that press card, how many times I had to actually get the police spokesperson on the line to reassure them, yes, this journalist is one of the few people who is going through. And then the celebrations were really tiny, very choreographed, very organized. And this year was meant to be the ultimate contrast. Israel seemingly entering post-pandemic mode, this big celebration taking place. It was really kind of that moment for people to let their hair down. And in this tragic irony, it ended in this kind of chaotic scene and in this misery.
Now, I know that you have been to visit some of the victims, those who were injured in particular, in hospital. How's that gone?
Yeah, I mean, that's been very difficult and very distressing from the point of view that, you know, I've been in a hospital that they had to call in 200 extra staff on the night of the crisis. I mean, 200 extra staff in a hospital. You're really talking about pushing the place up to full capacity, beyond full capacity. The remarkable thing is that most of them were actually discharged quite quickly. And what I did have was a very moving conversation with one of the people who was caught in what he described basically a pile of bodies. And he really did not believe that he couldn't breathe for several minutes. And he was so grateful to get out of there. And that's the contrast that we have with the injured people, because on the one hand, they have gone through really very distressing experiences. But on the other hand, they have a great sense of gratitude that they are still alive.
And have the witnesses actually described it from their perspective? Do we have a better understanding of what actually went on? All we see is the word stampede reported in the media. But have any of those who were actually caught up in it been a little more descriptive in what actually went on?
Yeah, I mean, so there's actually a bit of a backlash here against the use of the word stampede because of its connotations, that it relates to often animals, because of the kind of technical categorization of that word stampede. There is a move against that word, and what we're talking about more is the idea of a crush, the idea that people were slipping at the front and that was somehow causing a buildup of pressure. But what we're waiting for is formal and official investigations to understand exactly what happened, exactly why there wasn't more health and safety oversight at the site, and also to understand the conduct of the police and how that panned out.
What's the political response to this? Because in the last week, we've heard Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu respond to it. But what sort of other responses have there been, official responses, shall we say?
So Israel's state watchdog has already come out and said, you know, it seems that this was avoidable. So that's kind of quite a big moment. And what we're also seeing is that the opposition leader, Yair Lapid, has basically said a similar thing, that this should have been avoidable, that this should not have happened. And what we're hearing here is a lot of discussion of, well, why exactly did it happen? Why were so many people allowed to go to a site that really wasn't able to cater for that many people? And what a lot of Israelis are coming back to is this very complicated dynamic in government, that you have ultra-Orthodox parties in government that push back very hard against any move to limit religious ceremonies. And people are starting to ask, you know, was that at the centre? Was that concern that the Orthodox parties would resent it if numbers were limited? Was that actually part of this story?
Do you think, just finally, that based on the news we've heard, that Benjamin Netanyahu has now had to admit, this is the news that we're hearing here anyway, that he's had to admit he cannot form a coalition, and of course, again, Israel will seek a new prime minister. Do we think that this was the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back?
No, I think actually that his failure in forming a government was kind of cemented before this incident. There are various things that happened in the last couple of weeks that really kind of interfered with his chances. So this just seems to have been kind of an incident that really put a damper on the whole nation, really took the whole nation into a negative place before this happened. But I don't think it did actually interfere with the coalition building process.
Nathan Jaffe, journalist based in Israel, thank you very much indeed for updating us on this situation. This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, a campaign was launched quite recently in order to build a memorial to commemorate those who have died of COVID-19. Initially, the project was set to be in a digital capacity, but now it seems to have taken a turn to make more of a physical attempt at the memorial. I am perfectly honoured to say that joining us on the Jewish News Podcast now to discuss this further is businessman and philanthropist Sir Lloyd Dorfman, CBE. Now, Sir Lloyd, first and foremost, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to speak to us on the Jewish News Podcast. If we start off with the origins of this project, because as I said, this was initially supposed to be more of a digital thing, as it were, rather than actual physical memorial. Is that right?
Well, not quite right. The important thing is it started off as an online memorial book. And it began in the sort of depths of early lockdown last year, early April. I happened to have a relationship with St. Paul's Cathedral. That actually came out of as a result of my relationship with Westminster Abbey, which obviously you'll realize is a nice Jewish boy that seems a bit left field, but it's actually been two very wonderful relationships. And I had this developing relationship with St. Paul's Cathedral. And in early April last year, I was on a Zoom discussing various things. And then almost towards the end of the meeting, as a throwaway comment, Nikki Wynn, who is the head of development at St. Paul's Cathedral, said that she'd just been landed this project, which had resulted from a conversation between the Bishop of London, Sarah Mullally, and the Dean of St. Paul's Cathedral, David Eisen, because thousands of people were dying. There weren't proper funerals, if any proper funerals were being had at all. People weren't getting a chance to say goodbye to their loved ones. Everybody was very distressed. And they felt it was really important that St. Paul's should put together this online book of memory for all those people who died as a result of COVID. And it should absolutely be for people of all faiths and none. It wasn't just a Christian memorial book. But she said that the only problem was she had no money. They'd furloughed everybody, so there was no people, and she'd been told to do this quickly, and she didn't know quite where to start. And I suppose I was the sort of right guy at the right place at the right time, and I said, look, this is an incredible project and really important that you get on with this, and we've got to do this. So don't worry about the money. I'll put up whatever's needed. And you want me to make some calls to help make the memorial site come together and design it? And I played a sort of leadership role in doing that. And to cut a long story short, we had the site up and running in 5 weeks. But it was always the plan, that at some point down the road, there will also be a physical memorial in the cathedral itself, which is now the next part of the project we're coming on to.
Now, as you've quite rightly identified, though, that this, of course, is for multi-faith. It's not necessarily those who follow Christianity. I'm just wondering why a cathedral was potentially felt. Obviously, it's the involvement of St. Paul's Cathedral is pivotal to the actual project. But what the thinking was behind the cathedral itself being the best place for it?
Well, as I came to learn, St. Paul's Cathedral has this historic role of being the sort of nation's remembrancer for great events and great tragedies. And therefore, it seemed particularly appropriate that St. Paul's Cathedral, not only because of this historic role, because, as you know, you'll be aware that there are those iconic shots of its dome during the Second World War. It's a symbol of sort of defiance and hope, and seemed on many levels a very appropriate place to sort of to embody this memorial, both digital and physical. And the great beauty of this whole project is not only will it contain a physical memorial, but as I said, there will be digital screens in and around the area around the memorial itself. So people can come and visit the cathedral, visit the memorial, and at the same time access the digital screens to access their online memories.
I live in hope that this isn't a daft question, but why was it important to you to get involved with this particularly?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I mean, and I suppose it goes back to my involvement with the Westminster Abbey project, which happened a few years ago. This was the first building project at Westminster Abbey for 275 years. It was to build what's called the Triforium Tower up the Parliament side of the Abbey, which basically takes people up to the first floor of the Abbey, which sits about 90 feet above the Abbey floor, which opened a couple of years ago as the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Galleries, and from which they display all the artefacts they have in the Abbey that nobody ever gets to see. So as I said to my wife, the first day I ever went to see and understand what it was all about, she said, you know, what was all that about? And I said, well, you know, this is not any old church. This is a national church, and this is the seat of the coronations of our kings and queens. And don't think church, think museum. And as it so happens, I mean, this project, which was, if I remember rightly, it's something like a £24 million project, and there are probably about 30 donors supporting this project. And of those approximately 30 donors, there were 6 Jewish families, of which we were one, who had supported it. And I remember early December, a couple of years before it opened, I was there one early December morning for the laying of the foundation stone by the Prince of Wales, who was the patron of the project. And I was there with another one of my fellow Jewish donors to the project, a very distinguished man who's a bit older than me. And we were walking through the Abbey, sort of half joking about what were two nice Jewish boys doing walking through the Abbey on a Friday morning. And he sort of stopped me and he said, you know, Lloyd, though, he said, I think it's really important that we do this. He said, because he said, I think this is a way of us saying thank you to this country that opened its arms to our forefathers all those generations ago and gave them an opportunity to make of their lives what they will in a free and open democratic society. And I thought that was a lovely notion. And I think it's important as a community that, you know, we do a lot of very good work looking after our own, as every community should do. But at the same time, I think it's important that we also play our role in supporting the wider community. And it so happens, I think, the Jewish community in this country punches well above its weight in terms of the many, many projects across every aspect of our lives that we support. So the St. Paul's Cathedral sort of part of all this, you know, here was, you know, a pandemic, you know, when have we ever been through sort of national or global lockdown, thousands of people dying. As I said earlier, I had to be the right person, the right place, the right time. And I didn't think twice that this was really important for our country, for everybody, for people who had lost loved ones, that this was done. I was in a position to do it and happy to do it, and not only just to support it financially, but also help make it happen and design it.
Those who have lost loved ones during this pandemic, particularly in our community, based on the work that your family does to support the community, I think many people find what you all do a great comfort. I'm wondering whether or not that you have words, perhaps, that you would like to say to members of our community who have experienced loss during this time.
Yeah, nothing that I can say, nothing that anybody can say will bring them back. You know, each one of these losses is a terrible tragedy. Through in this generation, you know, we certainly don't know, never been through anything like this before. But I think, and this comes back to your earlier question about why St. Paul's is the sort of location for this, and that I often say that, you know, this memorial is not going to bring any of these loved ones back. But what it will do is to take these people who've died, and instead of being just numbers in a pandemic death toll, rather like we listen to the sort of news in the evening and we get told how many people have died during the day, et cetera, but here is a way of bringing these people and giving them a place in the sort of permanent history of this country by being part of this both digital and physical memorial at this historic national icon, St. Paul's Cathedral. And it's not going to bring them back, but at least it gives them some distinguished place in our history. There won't just be statistics during what people will refer to as the pandemic.
Just finally, if anyone wants to maybe get involved, help, maybe the fundraising side of it, whatever it may be, where can they go? How can they do so?
They should go to the online memorial site, which is Remember Me, Remember Me. That's the whole point. The whole memorial is called Remember Me, rememberme2020.uk. I would encourage everybody listening and anybody they know who've lost anybody, please go to the website, put your lost loved ones onto the site. It's absolutely free of charge. There's no cost whatsoever. You can include a message, you can include a photograph if you want to. And, you know, we're keen to get as many people on the site as possible. If you wanted to donate as well to the physical memorial, for which we're fundraising at the moment, it would cost around 2.3 million. Then you'll also find a donate button on the site. And obviously, any and every gift is hugely appreciated. And, you know, please pass on the word, particularly for people to put their lost loved ones down in the site.
Businessman and philanthropist Sir Lloyd Dorfman, CBE, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us on the Jewish News Podcast.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, the UK ambassador to Israel has honoured a British soldier a century on from where he saved at least 100 Jews during the 1921 Jaffa riots. Major Lionel Mansell-Juan was the commander of the port when riots broke out on the 1st of May, and his actions are credited with saving the lives of at least 100 Jews and an unknown number of Arabs. To speak to me further about this, I'm absolutely honoured and delighted to say that His Excellency, the UK Ambassador, Neil Wigan, joins me now. Ambassador Wigan, first and foremost, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to speak to us on the Jewish News Podcast. That is immeasurably appreciated. Could we perhaps start off with a brief history lesson, if you will? Who was Major Juan, for those who don't really know much about him? Because I confess, I haven't heard his name.
No, so he's one of those figures who nobody has really heard about, but an Israeli historian called Shmuel Geller did some research into it, and that led to the event last Sunday. He was a British Army officer who served in the army during the First World War, and after the First World War came to Mandate Palestine, where he served as head of the Jaffa port and the Jaffa lighthouse, including commanding a contingent of police at the port. And that's how, on the day of the Jaffa riots, he became involved and where he stepped into history.
Well, for someone who stepped so remarkably into history, considering he's quite little known to, well, I hope this will change after today, but considering that up until quite recently he was little known, I'm just wondering where the idea came from to commemorate his life. Were you sort of at the initial discussions, or how did you first get involved with making sure that this event that happened on Sunday actually did take place?
So instead, it's Israeli historian Shmuel Geller, who I know and who is fascinated by the history of the Mandate and of Jaffa in particular. And he was investigating the Jaffa riots as we came up to the 100th anniversary of them on the 1st of May. And while he was doing research, he came across the story of Major Juan and became fascinated by this individual who, on a truly awful day, but managed to achieve so much and save so many lives through an act of personal bravery, and then to a large extent vanished from the history books. At the time, people like Chaim Weizmann wrote to praise what he did, so people noticed at the time, but the history, they didn't really record him until now.
Tell us a little bit about the ceremony that took place on Sunday just gone. You obviously were there yourself. Who else was present?
So I was there along with my defence attaché to honour him as a member of the British Army, but also the mayor of Tel Aviv, Jaffa, Ron Huldai, came along, and Isaac Herzog, the chairman of the Jewish Agency, which of course is the sort of the ancestor of the House of the Pioneers, where Major Juan rescued so many people. Dan Tolkowski, who was an RAF pilot during the Second World War and then became head of the Israeli Air Force after independence, so he represents a particular historical link. and a whole mixture of people interested in this particular period of history. And we came to open a plaque to him, which sits perfectly just above Jaffa Port, which he was in charge of, and just below the historic lighthouse of Jaffa. And we held the ceremony just at sunset as the sun was going down over the Mediterranean. And it was a really beautiful event, and particularly on a national day of mourning in Israel after the tragedy at Hamaron, this was a very nice event to see.
Now, obviously, speaking of Mount Meron, it would be remiss of me not to mention it, because obviously it is being deemed as one of the darkest days in Israel's history, really, and quite rightly so.
Yes, I mean, obviously it's particularly sad because the pilgrims, the people there, were going to seek blessings, to seek a better future in many ways. It's a very happy event celebrating Lag BaOmer, and it was one of the first really big religious festivals which has been allowed to go ahead since Corona started. So it should have been a very joyful and positive occasion, and that makes it particularly tragic that it ended up this way. And as you say, people are calling it the worst peacetime disaster in Israel's history.
Just getting back to this event that took place last Sunday and the plaque that was installed, what was that like in terms of the post-pandemic Israel that we're sort of seeing a snapshot of? Was there a decent turnout? Was it a case of that people were keeping their distance? I'm just wondering sort of how it works, because obviously still in the UK, okay, our vaccination program is coming along marvellously, but at the same time, we're not allowed to meet in large gatherings. And I just wonder how events are allowed to take place in Israel.
So Israel is, I mean, because of the really extraordinary pace of its vaccination rollout, is probably a couple of months ahead of the UK. And so now outdoor events like this are allowed to happen. You no longer need to wear a mask at outdoor events. And so people need to keep a little bit of distance. But it did feel much more like a return to normality and to be able to hold events like this. And it was certainly one of the first that I've been able to do to see people publicly like that. And there's a huge enthusiasm for that. I mean, as you know, Israelis are love getting out and about. They're very sociable. So you can see the cafes and the restaurants of Tel Aviv are really getting buzzing again.
What strikes me as quite poignant with this commemorating of Major Juan is obviously we know that it was poignant based on what happened with the event on Friday at Lag BaOmer. But it also seems quite poignant to the fact that despite the bad publicity that Israel has received in the past, when it comes to this, I hate the expression, but you know, they use the expression, this is an apartheid state, which of course we all know is utter nonsense. But what's quite nice is that it's honouring a man who clearly didn't distinguish between someone's background. As I said in my introduction, he saved at least 100 Jews and an unknown number of Arab civilians as well. And I think that that is a message that we can all really learn from, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, there were nice echoes of that in the tragedy at Hamaron, where you had people from Druze villages, from Arab villages in the area coming out to help the survivors and give them support. So it's really lovely when you see the communities coming together to help each other at times of crisis, but also, as with Major Jeanne, to see how individuals acting with integrity and honour will look after people of all communities and do their honour and their duty.
Well, let us hope that he inspires as many as he absolutely deserves to. Ambassador Neil Wigan, thank you very much indeed for telling us about the life and achievements of Major Lionel Mansel Juan on the Jewish News Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. Now, a social enterprise which helps homeless people has been given the Royal Seal of Approval after winning the prestigious Queen's Award for Enterprise. Beam, which was founded by entrepreneur Alex Stephanie, uses crowdfunding to help people who are homeless. And I'm very pleased to say that to tell us more about it, Alex joins me now. Alex, first and foremost, mazel tov on the award. That's terribly exciting.
Thank you.
Now, I don't want to take for granted that everyone has heard of the marvellous work that Beam do. So a chance to shine, like a beam, haha. Tell us what it is that you do.
Well, I'll tell you first how Beam got started, and then you'll sort of understand how it all works. So I became friends with a homeless man who would sit outside my tube station, and I would buy this guy cups of coffee, but I could see his condition just getting worse with every passing week. At one point, he actually disappeared, and then when he reappeared, he told me that he'd had a heart attack. And I remember the very first time we met, he told me that he'd been out of work as long as he could remember, for many, many years. And when I was walking home after he told me he'd had this heart attack, it hit me so hard that nothing I'd really done had made a real difference to this man's life. He was still reliant on me and many other people for the things that he needed in his life. So I thought, what this guy needed wasn't, you know, another coffee, but it was the skills, it was the support to get back into work and to provide for himself. And I thought, well, that's going to cost more than a coffee, but what if we all chip in? What if we could use crowdfunding to essentially make really smart investments into homeless people, giving them bright new futures? And that's exactly what we do on Beam.org. So it's a crowdfunding platform that allows anyone anywhere in the world to make a donation to help a homeless person get new skills and back into work and back onto their feet. And we've now helped hundreds of homeless people here in London. These are people typically living in homeless hostels and women's refuges to get new skills and new jobs at some of the UK's most established businesses, from the likes of Ocado to the NHS, Sainsbury's, Asda, and many, many other companies.
Now, there's one thing that really sticks in my craw when it comes to dealing with those who do find themselves homeless in this country. And it's, I don't necessarily throw my weight behind a lot of causes, because obviously the nature of my job, I try to be balanced and feature as many good causes as possible, but I am quite vocal when it comes to homelessness. Because what I don't understand is, for such a wealthy country, I find it absolutely staggering that our monetary system is not in the least bit geared towards those who are homeless. So, for example, there are some people who live in a homeless environment, whether that be in a hostel, whether it be on the streets, whatever it may be. And let's say they want to open a bank account. One of the first things they need to do is provide a proof of address. Well, they don't have an address. So what happens then? Well, they get stuck in a rut. It's a continuous cycle, a vicious cycle at that. And I find it absolutely unbelievable that we claim to be one of the wealthiest countries, and yet on our very own doorstep, this happens.
Well, I think one of the things that we've seen firsthand is how goods and services and technology have really been built for wealthy, privileged consumers, and how the needs of disadvantaged people and poor people, for want of a better word, have been ignored for decades and really centuries. And one of the things that we're really passionate about doing as a tech startup, as well as a social enterprise, is to build technology for people who are really at the bottom of society that is just as good as the technology that you or I might enjoy from a Spotify or an Airbnb. And that's a really different approach that we have compared to many organizations in this space. We're very, very technologically led. So, you know, really it's about sort of righting this wrong. And of course, it's something that does affect all of us, not just the hundreds of thousands of people who are homeless in this country, because if you're a taxpayer in this country, then you're, of course, living in an economy that is hit by the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of people who are out of work and need to remain welfare dependent, and you have a government that spends billions of pounds each year on this problem. So it's really a win-win when you can actually give new skills and new opportunities to people that allows them to get back on their feet and to become socially integrated people who are doing great jobs and adding value and contributing.
But on an even more relatable level, I would throw in that let's not pretend that any of us are immune to homelessness. The awful truth is that anything could happen at any given time that means that our circumstances that many of us take for granted could change, that would see it do a 180 and actually be just as, I don't like the word vulnerable because it sort of implies some sort of victims, but you know what I mean. It could see us in a similar sort of position if we're not careful. But look, this is not about me ranting. This is about finding out more about you. And I'm quite keen to find out what it means for those who win the Queen's Award for Enterprise. Have you got some sort of fancy award ceremony you've been to or that you are due to go to post-pandemic? What about that side of things?
Well, there is, I think, an event at Buckingham Palace, and we get some commemorative crystal trophy, I believe, and we're all very excited about us being able to fly a Royal Queen's Enterprise flag above our office, so we get the right to do that for 4 or 5 years. I'm not sure how our co-working space will feel about putting a flag on top of the building. So there are some of these sort of, yeah, really nice perks to the award, but you know, I'm a small part of Beam in some ways. I get a disproportionate amount of the credit, but there are, you know, we have a team of 30. We're hiring for, you know, 15 more people at the moment. By the end of the year, we should be around 50 people. I'm a very small percentage part of this, and really, it's just nice to get a recognition for the whole team, because it's it is true teamwork that allows these things to happen. And there are, you know, we have a fantastic operational team. Each person who uses the Beam service, they're referred to us by a charity or by a local authority, and they have a caseworker at Beam. And we have a fantastic, really committed group of people who provide this one-to-one support that is necessary to help individuals who have been out of work on average more than 5 years, to get them prepared and to get them settled into a new job. And then they provide 6 months of support once they're in that new job. As you can imagine, there's a lot of challenges that they need to work with, and you know, they do an awful lot of work incredibly well to make all these things happen.
You mentioned earlier on about how all of the money is raised through crowdfunding. Do you know roughly how much you've raised to date?
It's just over £2 million now.
Wow.
So that's come from about 60,000 different donations, and people either give one-off, but increasingly people give each month. And each month they get an email saying who they have helped this month, and they can click through and they can see the person that they're helping, they can read the story of that individual, and they can also see a transparent budget that breaks down all of the costs for that individual's campaign to the nearest pound. And these are things like training and tools and textbooks and childcare, because a lot of the people we work with have children as well, and all of the other sorts of little bits and bobs that people need that, you know, for middle-class people, they would think, you know, nothing of. But for people without money in their bank account are real obstacles that can hold people back for many, many years. And so, yeah, that's how most people give now. It's through these monthly donations.
Well, it's thanks to people like you that those obstacles are slowly but surely being eroded away. And we thank you for it, sir. Alex Stephanie, founder of Beam, mazel tov again on the award, and bravo for everything that you do. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for this episode of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. Through its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. For more information, you can visit gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is to say thank you to our guests, Nathan Jaffe, Sir Lloyd Dorfman, CBE, His Excellency Ambassador Neil Wigan, Alex Stephanie, and our paper review team. Of course, they were Richard Ferrer and Justin Cohen. And of course, we must say thank you to Justin Cohen for producing this episode of the Jewish News Podcast. Please do subscribe to the show in your podcast application. That's where you'll hear any previous episode or be informed when new ones become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. And if you'd like to comment, well, then we'd love to hear from you. You can email editorial@thejngroup.com. That's editorial@thejngroup.com. From me, Phil Dave, do join us next time here on the Jewish News Podcast. Goodbye.